I do think we need to have space for people to gather outside the Dáil. You know, there was talk of like exclusion zones outside Leinster House. And I would not like to see a situation where politicians become ever more detached from people.
My guest today could be described as a seasoned politician, even though he's only 31 years old. Fintan Warfield has been an elected representative for almost 10 years now, and he's even a former mayor of South Dublin Council. He's been a member of Shannadarran since 2016 and is the Sinn Féin spokesperson on youth affairs, LGBT rights and the arts. He's also an accomplished musician and has toured widely with the Young Wolf Tones. Fintan Warfield, you're very welcome to the studio. You've publicly spoken about the irony in the fact that you campaigned for the abolition of the Shannad in the referendum of 2014, and you've been in there now for the last 7 years, albeit somebody who's campaigning for it to be reformed. But is it something you're glad that, you know, in hindsight, the Irish people decided to keep the Senate?
I am glad, yeah. I think two chambers, having experienced two terms in the Shannad, I think two chambers is a positive thing for our politics. Sinn Féin did campaign for its abolition. I was part of that campaign. We felt it was elitist. We felt that it would not be reformed. We were proved true in terms of the absence of reform. But, you know, I said at the time, Republicans won't leave any chamber to the other party. So we ran our candidates. Look, I've also been inspired by the work of David Norris over the years. He's been an incredible guy for my community, for gay men and for LGBT people more generally. So I certainly thought it would be a space that I could work with groups and NGOs and bring forward legislation and try and be a kind of campaigning senator as well.
And for all its shortcomings, and there are many, not least the electoral system itself and how narrow that is, do you think it works fairly well in scrutinising legislation, for instance, and holding ministers to account?
Not when it's packed with a huge government majority. In my first term, there was obviously a balance between government and the opposition in the Shannad. This term, we've about of 60 senators, there are 40 government senators and 20 opposition. So the Taoiseach's nominees particularly were used for the political parties this time, more so than the last term. And that's had a huge impact, I think, kind of on the dynamic, on the your potential to get things done. You know?
And is it your intention to just try to stay being elected to the Shannad, or do you intend looking for a nomination to run for the Dáil?
I would certainly consider running again for the Shannad. Yeah, we'll see what the next couple of months has in store.
But you're obviously up for the electoral fray, irrespective of where that may take you.
Yeah, it hasn't been an easy point to get to either. The last couple of years have been quite difficult for me in politics. There's been a lot of online abuse that's taken its toll as well on me and those around me. So yeah, I've given a lot of consideration. I've kind of found my balance again. I have more balance now than I did over the last couple of years, so in a better space to kind of consider the next steps.
Tell me about your first foray into electoral politics. You became a county councillor, and in no time at all you were mayor of South Dublin County Council with all the trappings. I mean, did you have a car and driver at the age of 23 or whatever?
No, South Dublin County Council had removed the car and the driver. I ran the election campaign in 2014 using mum and dad's car, and I always thought my sister was very inconsiderate in my election campaign because she was also demanding the car to go to friends' houses or to go to swimming or whatever. So,
and how did you end up as the mayor?
Well, we returned the largest team to South Dublin County Council after the 2014 local elections. I had been campaigning on and speaking at Ardeshina about the right of same-sex couples to civil marriage.
But what had that got to do with South Dublin County Council?
Well, I was a young queer councillor and the referendum for civil marriage equality was fast approaching, and we thought it would be beneficial to the campaign to have an openly gay person in that role, but also a young person as well. You know, I was politicised around the time of the financial crash, and so we felt a young person in that role would make a significant change.
Yeah, but being the mayor of a council is a fairly serious business. You wouldn't have had a huge amount of experience by definition at that stage, Fintan. I mean, how did you find working with officials and county managers and that kind of thing? I mean, like, the fear would be that they would run rings around you, being quite so young.
Well, some of our councillors, even though it's a part-time role, were full-time councillors out in Tallaght. We had a really good team around me and we worked well with the county manager. The meetings administrator became my best mate, to be honest. All the heads of services in South Dublin County Council were incredible and were always there for you, you know.
Is there anything, though, that you can point to in terms of, look, you know, I did that. That wouldn't have happened in South County Dublin if I hadn't been the mayor.
Well, I think just as a council, you're the symbolic face of the council. That's
chain and all,
the chain gang. You're the symbolic face of the council, so you represent the council at multiple events every day. So you'd be driving around from Clondalkin to Tallaght. But also, and it's not just the mayor's record, but also the record of the ruling group at the time. We increased investment into homelessness. We doubled investment into homeless services in South Dublin County Council. So primarily budgetary decisions that were taken that were positive and progressive.
Before you became active in politics, by which I mean electoral politics, I know you joined Sinn Féin, I think, at the age of 16. The option, I suspect, of being a professional full-time musician was there for you.
Dad sat us down, myself, my brother, my sister, every night when we'd come home from school to practice and rehearse violin, classical music first, and then when we kind of all fell away from the theory side, particularly, we were ushered into traditional music. So Dad was always steadfast in his view that this was not a career.
Even though the family name Warfield, I mean, people won't need a whole lot of reminding to join the dots that your father's cousins were in the Wolf Tones and doing very well at it, Derek and Brian Warfield.
Yeah, maybe that was the reason why he didn't want us to go into it, but I never did what I was told. And when I was in Galway at 17, after the Leaving Cert, I made it my mission to get to know Derek and to get to know the band and to hopefully perform and tour with them around the world. And that came true. You don't really get to know your second cousin, or I didn't, but Derek always sent CDs and books to the house, and Dad would have always been the kind of guy who would sit us down and make us write thank you letters to people who had sent cards or gifts. So I obviously established a kind of relationship in the distance with Derek. I would later be kind of politicised by his music and his songs.
And the Wolf Tones and the Young Wolf Tones, just explain the difference. What's the background there?
The Wolf Tones were Derek Warfield, Brian Warfield, Noel Nagel and Tommy Byrne, set up in 1963. Derek left that band in 2001. He had his own band for many years in America, performing Civil War songs and Irish songs from the American Civil War. Derek took the decision to leave the band around the early 2000s, and later that decade formed his own band, Derek Warfield and the Young Wolf Tones.
And you were part of that for how long?
5 years at least.
So you could have made a career out of it.
I could still make a career. It's a good plan B.
Yeah, because you sing, you play the violin or the fiddle and the guitar. So, you know, what's not to travel with?
Yeah, yeah. I just need the visa for America and then you'd be good to go. It's such a lovely kind of balance to have with politics, to have a creative output as well, you know.
Tell me more about growing up, because your teenage years were difficult ones from anything I've read or heard about you.
I probably knew about my sexuality when I was about 10. So for 7 years, that part of my life, who I was attracted to, was kept secret from everybody. So, yeah, but like growing up was lovely at the same time. You know, we grew up in Harold's Cross, beautiful place to grow up, played football. It's a nice location in Dublin. It's kind of between the posh side of Dublin and the more working class side of Dublin as well. So we had friends all over, played football, played sport growing up. So it was a lovely upbringing.
And then rather than go to a third level at college or university in Dublin, you decided to go west.
I feel like most gay or lesbian or LGBT people in rural Ireland might come to Dublin, but when you're in Dublin and you need to come out, you have to go somewhere else. And I was attracted by the prospect of a kind of cultural city, a kind of bohemian city as well. And so I applied to go to GMIT, Atlantic Technological University. Now I love the notions in that. So I went down there. I lived in Glasson, a student village, for 3 years.
That's quite close to the GMIT, or as you say, the ATU.
Quite close to the Dublin Road out as well. But I eventually fell in love in the last few months of the 3 years. Came out to friends in Galway over the course of my time there. You know, ideally you would go there and start a whole new life and come out just as fresh, but that's not how it works either. So
there's an interesting story about how you came out to your family.
Well, I came out to friends in Galway first, and then I came out to friends at home, and then I came out to my brother and sister, and then I came out to mum and dad.
Wasn't there something about a late late show as part of the story?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, so you never really know how your family are going to take it, because they have this impression of you, or you certainly think that they have an impression of you growing up that is heterosexual that fancies people of the other sex. I remember Donal Ogue had come out in his book. Donal Ogue Cusack came out. I played GAA as well. I played in goal. And he came out in the book, and then he had an interview on the Late Late Show. And I remember Mum watching on and just being so impressed by him and making comments about how brilliant he was to do that. So I think from that point on, I knew that if I would ever come out, that it would be safe to do that in the house. But even at that, as I think back now, you even make kind of alternative plans, or you think about what happens if your mum and dad don't accept you, you know? So even at that, I would have thought like where I would stay that night if I came out, you know?
And how long did it take you to decide to be open with your parents after that Late Late Show?
I can't remember the exact time, to be honest, Sean.
But it wasn't on the night?
No, certainly not, no. No.
And how did it go then when you talked to them?
We were actually going on an interrail. My friends, I'm still friends with the core group of four boys I grew up with in Harold's Cross. One now lives in Kilrush and the others live around Dublin. But we were going interrailing the following morning and we were having drinks across the road with my friends. So I obviously had too much drink. But this was the plan was to tell Mum and Dad that night. So I obviously had a bit too much drink as well. So anyway, I went back across the road. My friend lives directly across the road, you know. Went back across the road and told Mum and Dad that I didn't fancy girls. I couldn't even articulate that I fancied men. And they said, we love you, we still love you, we'll always love you, and we just want you to be safe. And I went back across the road, snuck back in, went to bed, and we went interrailing the next day for 3 weeks. And we didn't have a phone call for a few days. And I remember being on the banks of a canal in Amsterdam and calling Dad, or Dad calling me, and just talking about the Pats match that Friday night and how it went, St. Patrick's Athletic and Inchicore. We didn't need to talk about it. I just knew that all was good, you know.
But it was far from plain sailing, though. I mean, when you got to Galway,
Galway,
you had some bad
Galway
incidents.
Galway wasn't the progressive city that I may have thought it to be. And so, yeah, I mean, during the course of the 3 years, there was a homophobic attack. We were in the dance floor. We were on the dance floor and I was looking across at another guy and he was looking at me and I was looking at him, and his friend came over. He said, don't look at my friend. Stop looking at my mate. And I was like, okay, no worries. It's not what I thought it was. So that's cool. And then from behind the guy who had confronted me came another friend who kind of gave me a dig in the face. So I decided to leave the club. I didn't tell the folks I was there with that I was leaving. And so I left the club and a group of them followed me onto Air Square. And there was kind of more physical violence then. But yeah, so I was able to just get in a taxi and get away. But obviously, I never reported it. Like, you don't really think to report it. And then you also don't know how the guards will.
And it wasn't just fellas that were attacking you, was it?
No, it was women as well. And that's often, you know, they say sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can never hurt you. It's actually the words that you remember all these years later, you know, shouting across at you, you know. So it's grim. And you know what? It's happening every month in the GCN and the LGBT press. In Ireland, there's reports of physical violence.
That's the gay community news.
Yeah, physical violence on the streets in Dublin, you know, and two men obviously killed tragically in Sligo last year. So we have a way to go.
Coming and going from the Shannon, you've had some difficult moments as well.
Yeah, I was on the Camino. I went on my own in January 2022. On New Year's Eve, I flew to Porto. I'll come back to your question, but I figured out that I could walk the Camino Portuguese in January in good weather. And so I walked from Porto on New Year's Day up to Santiago. Took a couple of weeks. We've good time off in January. As you know, politicians have good time off in January. So this was the time I used to go away. And I kind of needed it as well. And so I got back very zen. Chill as you like. No one was going to burst my bubble. A changed man. I got to Leinster House on the first day back, walking in, and there was a guy there who said, did I want to do an interview with the National Party? And I said, and I told him where to go. The National Party and other far-right groups had kind of been central to the abuse that I'd gotten online and that Roderick O'Gorman had gotten just in the weeks prior to me. So that put me in bad humour, Sean. I told him where to go in no uncertain terms. And then it kind of escalated into a verbal exchange where I wasn't too proud of myself either, but he was, you know, talking about how I was pushing sex on kids and all of these tropes that gay people and LGBT people have to listen to often online. So that burst my bubble fairly quickly coming back to Leinster. I needed another Camino.
And were there other words of abuse along the same lines as that you had to endure in Galway?
The only other F word was me calling him a fascist. No. But
now, you mentioned at the outset, or early on in our conversation, Fintan, that, you know, what you're getting by way of abuse. I mean, can you just explain that or expand on it a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the online world, there's no presence there. It's so anonymous. There's a complete absence of presence. And I think, I don't know, have you read John O'Donoghue, any of John O'Donoghue's books?
I've dipped in occasionally, yeah.
Well, Adam Carra sits beside my bed, and exactly that, you can dip in and out. And John makes a lovely point about how essentially the online world is a world full of shadows, and we think it makes us more connected, but in reality it's much more lonely than we think. And I'm of an age where we gave everything to social media, you know, we still do to an extent, but I think we know now its limitations. But I think as well, online, people give away their, you know, people come up to me and say, oh, you know, I hate this guy, or I hate this guy in politics, or I hate this person, and make enemies of people and let your precious energy be stolen. And I think the anonymity of online allows us to just throw that abuse at people as well. So myself and Roderick as well endured a huge amount of abuse online during COVID for the type of work that we were doing. And so, yeah, it spills out into the street as well, and you're walking home from work and someone calls you a paedophile or whatever, and that happened on one occasion, and it made my partner at the time and me really worried. So there is something I want to say about, though, the scenes we saw outside the Doll recently. I do think we need to have space for people to gather outside the Doll. You know, there was talk of, like, exclusion zones outside Leinster House. And I would not like to see a situation where politicians become ever more detached from people. And rather than exclusion zones, I think we actually need to kind of pedestrianise either Molesworth Street or Kildare Street. Like you might see, I don't know if you've ever been outside the White House, and there's a plaza there where people can walk up and down all day long with their crazy ideas and their legit ideas and their good ideas and whatever.
Kind of Hyde Park Corner just outside Boswell's Hotel. Is that what you're thinking of?
They'll be delighted.
And are you capable at all, though, of just not looking at stuff or reading stuff that's abusive on social media?
Unfortunately, your job depends on your reputation and depends on what people are saying about you. I think that's a really unfortunate thing about politics, that you have to worry about what people think about you. Your job depends on it. And so while I do now have certain settings on social media that I don't see tags and stuff like that, every now and then there is a temptation to go in and check what is being said, you know. But I've almost completely distanced myself from Twitter. I haven't previously given loads of myself to it, you know. And that's what was great about social media. People gave themselves to it, and it was a positive place, but it's just become a really unhappy, negative platform.
In the Shannon, I think you've identified a couple of issues that would be priorities for you, among them lowering the voting age, also allowing everybody, even people younger than 18, to be paid the full minimum wage, as opposed to whether it's 70 or 80%, depending on their age, and also a conversion therapy bill. Now, where are you at on all of those things?
Well, the conversion therapy bill, my own proposal, probably won't move. I think the government quite proud of the fact that, having introduced the bill in the last term, it became a programme for government commitment to ban conversion therapy. So the Department of Equality and Integration have worked on research, and they're going to bring forward their own legislation on that. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, you mentioned the issue of sub-minimum rates of pay. Another issue I think that is very important at the moment is the issue of the nighttime economy. We've seen like 500 clubs from the year 2000 reduced to about 82 or 80 clubs around the country, nightclubs. So we need legislation that will make it easier for people to operate in the nighttime economy, extend opening hours for young people, and just allow us to have more spaces to socialise and to have a variety and a diversity of spaces that don't just include the pub, you know.
On the conversion therapy legislation, I think there's been some controversy, maybe going back a couple of years, on the definition of conversion therapy. And, you know, there's some people who would be wary of suppression of gender identity. In other words, that it's something that could be used against people involved in the area of counselling where trans is concerned. I mean, what's your response to that?
I think this is an issue, the attempt to divide trans people from LGBT people is not uncommon in an attempt to drive a wedge between our community. So my bill was clear insofar as that it would only be a criminal offence if you attempted to suppress someone's gender identity, sexual orientation, or their gender expression. If you attempted to suppress it, repress it, or if you attempted to change it. And that's very much like the legislation they have in Malta. There's no suggestion that exploration of someone's gender identity particularly would result in a criminal offence. That's absolutely would not be the intention of the bill. And so, yeah, I look forward to the draft legislation that Roderick has brought forward, but I know he's very conscious of that as well. We're not going to tie the hands of health professionals in terms of exploring people's gender identity. That's not the intention. At the very, very least, we need a health service for trans young people, for young people and for trans people as well. So, and we don't have that in Ireland. But I'm also conscious, you know, as someone who is not trans, and there's no one trans in this room, and that we're part of the 99% of people who aren't trans, I think that we should be mindful that we have the benefit of never having been considered as mistaken or deluded about this really fundamental part of our personhood. One of the first things we intuit from a person is their gender. And we, therefore, you and I, live in a world where we're considered experts about our gender identity or our identity, and then by extension, about trans people's identities as well. And there's a bit of a problem in that, because we control positions of power, we control access to healthcare, we make laws, and actual trans people are very rarely to be seen in these conversations.
But on the question, though, Fintan, of free speech, for instance, what you're saying is it sort of the logical extension of what you're saying, that only people who are directly affected by this are the ones who have the right to a say?
No, but it's just that trans people's lives are chewed over by people, and they're made a culture war issue. I know people who are trans who've had hormone blockers who they're not causing anybody any harm, but their lives are just chewed over by people in the media, in politics, and their lives are just made a culture war issue. And I really feel for them. And not just trans people, but I think LGB people feel that pressure as well, because of how the lives of trans people are discussed in the press and in the media. So, yeah, I think often online people do try and shut down discussions. And I think we absolutely need to be able to have these discussions out. Yeah, that's the only way we can deal with them, you know.
These are issues, obviously, that are going to preoccupy politicians and the general public, I think, for a long time to come. Now, something that's perhaps going to be emerging maybe in the near term is another general election, 2 years at the most, maybe even a lot sooner. How confident are you that Sinn Féin is going to be the biggest party after that election? I mean, the polls would certainly seem to suggest that. Or do you think it's something that could, you know, change in the course of a campaign?
I think I would not take our support for granted. I think we want to obviously grow our support. That the local and European elections are first up. That is where we can start the change, where we can send government a message. But also not just to send the government a message, but because the local elections are, and for Republicans, they're an important part of our politics. We want decisions to be made as closely to people as possible. but the people will have their say about the result of the general election, but we will not take anything for granted. And there's a huge momentum, yes, behind Sinn Féin. People are rooting us on the doors. Our new candidates have been selected for the locals. People are rooting us on. They're relying on us to deliver change in housing, in terms of better pay and working conditions, in terms of investment in public services. So we've always been saying the same thing since I joined Sinn Féin at 16, you know, public housing, better pay and working conditions, and better investment in public services. It's still the message.
Which, if you like, is just ordinary retail politics, if I can put it like that. But there is the background to where Sinn Féin has come from. I mean, for instance, what do you think when you hear Gerry Adams deny that he was ever in the IRA?
I've no reason not to believe Gerry Adams when he says he wasn't in the IRA.
Are you serious?
But it also doesn't concern me. You know, I would have been inspired by Gerry Adams to join Sinn Féin. I would have been inspired by his contribution and that of Martin McGuinness in terms of moving the IRA and moving from a conflict situation to peace.
Anna, but seriously though, I mean, no reason not to believe Gerry Adams. I mean, what shower did you come down
in? How many times did you ask him?
Well, I mean, it became I won't say a running joke, but I don't think anybody believes. And Gerry Adams, to his credit, is the one who, as you say, along with Martin McGuinness, led the Republican movement away from the Armalite and exclusively towards peaceful politics, and also had the monumental achievement of keeping the party or the movement largely together, frayed a bit at the edges, very tragically, in the case of Republican Sinn Féin, and also the continuity era and various variations of it. But essentially, he kept the movement together. And, you know, history would be very kind to him on that basis. But I'm thinking as well, though, of people say like Maria Cahill and her experience, which is relatively recent. I don't know if you've read her book, Rough Beast. I mean, what do you make of that experience that she had?
I have not. No, I've not read the book.
But you know the story.
I know the story, yeah. And it's a very, very sad story. I know Mary Lou recently reiterated her absolute unreserved apology to Maria Cahill. And what happened was absolutely dreadful. It certainly would not happen today, but back at that point, the reporting structures did not exist, and I know she's reiterated her unreserved apology to Maria
Cahill. Yeah, but if you read that book, towards the end, Maria Cahill quotes verbatim an exchange, in fact, that I and Mary Lou had on the News at One, where Mary Lou's insisting that, you know, members of Sinn Féin cooperated fully with the PSNI investigation. But when you strip it down, it emerges that their definition of cooperation was to give written statements, but not to make themselves available for interview.
Yeah. Well, I haven't read the book, nor have I heard your interview with Mary Lou. But at no stage, and Mary Lou has said this, should any organisation other than statutory agencies and the police be involved in an investigation, and that was wrong.
Yeah, and what about the fact though that it reflects, it's a story and it's not unique. I mean, if there is such a thing, and it's a huge contradiction in terms of if there is such a thing as Sinn Féin royalty, Maria Cahill comes as close as there is to it, being the niece of Joe Cahill, a founder member of the Provisional IRA and Sinn Féin in its current form. And it was just the kind of existence that she was reared in, that like Sinn Féin stroke IRA, their writ ran in that area. And, you know, it's, if you like, it had, I don't know to what extent it still would have, a grip on ordinary people's lives in a way that was very oppressive, totalitarian, it has been suggested.
Yeah. And look, I think I can't imagine it was easy for Maria to step forward. And obviously I commend her and anybody who comes forward and tells their story. And so, yeah, commend her absolutely for the way that she has done that. That must not have been easy.
But is that kind of influence and hold, is that something that people should rightly be wary of, looking at Sinn Féin now?
Sinn Féin's elected by people in West Belfast and across the north. We're now the largest.
But who runs the show?
Sean. The Ord Corley run the show, and Mary Lou McDonald runs the show. Piers Doherty in the Dáil, Michelle O'Neill in the North.
Just in regard to policies, the observation has been made that as the election gets closer, Sinn Féin have been modifying its policies maybe to suit the needs of the moment. For instance, every referendum we've had on Europe, you've urged a no vote. But that seems to have, if you like, mutated into basically a pro-European attitude or disposition on the part of Sinn Féin. Every single European treaty, you've asked the people to vote no. Mm. Where climate change is concerned, you say, oh yeah, we're for measures. But when it comes to particular specific proposals and changes that, you know, they do pinch. And more than that, for a lot of people, like carbon taxes, you say, oh no, we're against that. So, you know, it's just maybe boxing that little bit clever.
We haven't always gotten it right on Europe, but I don't think we've always gotten it wrong either. I think in terms of climate, Sinn Féin have been, well, we don't agree with the carbon tax. And by the way, the environmental activists aren't agreed on the climate tax either. We do believe that ordinary people, working people, should not have to bear the brunt. So in terms of, you look at the latest figures from the EPA in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, only reduced by 1.9%. Some sectors, it's gone up. Transport has gone up by 6%. And the only sector that significantly reduced its emissions was residential, down by 12%. So I think that shows us that working people are being asked to do the heavy lifting, while other sectors are being let off the hook.
So it's just one of those things that, you know, with the exception, we'll say, of the idea of taxing, extra tax being imposed on people earning more than 100,000, there's not much sign of a willingness on the part of Sinn Féin to make hard calls. Now, you could say the same about the two governing parties as well, given the kind of largesse that's available.
I don't agree. I think hard calls, like, people are looking for change in terms of housing. Sinn Féin committed 1.5 billion extra over the government budget in terms of housing. I live in, you know, my age group. I may just be above 30, but we've seen the recent statistics by Eurostat first in terms of 68% of people between the age of 25 and 29 still living at home in their childhood bedrooms. The CSO have that figure at about 33%. But even still, it's going up since 2011. It's rising under Fine Gael.
Do you think that Sinn Féin is in a position to make a radical change, a radical improvement? Because there's all sorts of things like the supply of labour and so forth that restrain the development of new homes. That, you know, you can only have so much capacity. And, you know, they've set targets that have been realistic but not ambitious enough, you could say. But, you know, where are the workers to build the extra houses? It's not a shortage of money, in other words.
No, there's loads of problems. There's problems in the planning system. I mean, we allocated about 13 million euro in additional resources for the planning system on Bord Pleanála and local councils to resource the planning system. We need, ultimately, what this government won't do is a much greater level of state intervention to use public lands master planned by local authorities, delivered by private contractors, but to deliver affordable and social homes, taking our housing system, and I say system over instead of market, we need to treat our housing system to ensure, look at places that are doing it right. They have about 30% of their housing system is non-market homes. Vienna, large parts of Germany and Berlin, you will find 30% of non-market homes make up the stock. And that's where we need to move to in Ireland. And we also obviously need to protect renters in the private rental sector. But we will only get there by, you know, greater use of vacant properties, of low carbon building techniques, of purchasing turnkey properties as well for social and affordable homes that working people can rent and buy.
No matter how well Sinn Féin does at the next election, there's a consensus view among observers that it won't have a majority on its own. It would be an extraordinary achievement if it did get a Dáil majority. you know, stranger things have happened, I suppose. But what about coalition partners? Fine Gael have ruled themselves out fairly definitively. What about a Fianna Fáil Sinn Féin government? How would you feel about that, that kind of a coalition?
I probably wouldn't be allowed home to Dad. I don't concern myself with this question, to be honest. I think probably we need to have these conversations internally in the party. But for the moment, I'm not having these conversations with anybody. I want to see Sinn Féin. To be honest, I would like to see Sinn Féin win an overall majority. And my preference is a government without Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil.
Do you think you will see, we will see a united Ireland in some shape or form in your lifetime, which, you know, could expand or extend another 50, 60, 70 years?
Yeah, could do, yeah, but my life, it could do. I hope so. I joined Sinn Féin because I believed in the reunification of Ireland. I think partition is an historic wrong. It's created two conservative states on both sides of the border. Ultimately, I was thinking the other day, government in the north can be removed, can be taken away by London at any point. And if that's not colonial, well, then I don't know what is, if your government can be removed or taken away, you know. So, yes, I want, as I said earlier in our discussion, I think decisions should be taken as closely as possible to people. And I think we have a job of work to do in terms of persuading those who are open to persuasion. And indeed, those who are more entrenched in their view that we should not have the reunification of Ireland.
As John Hume often said, united Ireland is a matter or something that will come about when those who are in favour of it succeed in persuading those who are against it to change their view. Now, obviously, demographics have had an important input into how things have changed. But I'm wondering as well, I mean, we talk about persuasion. And we go back to the Wolf Tones here. Recently, I mean, there was quite a controversy, and it was one of your second cousins had a fairly vigorous exchange on Liveline with Joe Duffy about that song that the Wolf Tones played at the Féile an Phobail in Belfast, Celtic Symphony, which leads on to a line, ooh, ah, up the ra. Now, I mean, is that something that maybe, you know, Sinn Féin should use its influence to persuade people to step back from?
I think when it concerns our songs, I think it's much like the peace process. It's much like a parody of esteem, that people can sing songs, loyalist songs, and people can sing Republican songs, and we'll try and sing some of your songs and you try and sing some of ours. I'll give you a bar of the sash if you want.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's hard to imagine, or maybe it's not, the idea of, you know, lambeg drums being played at the Féile in Belfast. I mean, I was interested in an observation made by Joe Brawley, whose father was a Sinn Féin representative in Northern Ireland, that in order to reconcile properly with people of good faith in the other community, something like ooh-ah, up-the-rah, it just has to go.
Yeah, no, I heard Joe Brawley's comments. What I would be afraid of in this conversation is that we have a repertoire of songs, an archive of songs in our heritage. Some are more gruesome than that. I'm thinking about, like, Follow Me Up to Carlow, about Fiach McHugh O'Neill in the Wicklow Mountains, the Battle of Glenmalure in 1690, written by P.J. McCall, who wrote some great songs like Bula Vogue and Kelly the Boy from Killan.
Not forgetting Our Own Aveen.
Exactly, Our Own Aveen, written by Paddy Carney. So where does it stop if I say to you, yeah, that song, yeah, that should go. That song needs to go, you know. So where does it stop? Reminded of a quote often attributed to Frank Hart. Those in power write the history, and those who struggle write the songs. And if I had a minute to read out a quote from James Connolly, I brought a Connolly songbook here with me. He says, "No revolutionary movement is complete without its poetical expression. If such a movement has caught hold of the imagination of the masses, they will seek a vent in songs for the aspirations, the fears and hopes, the loves and hatreds engendered by the struggle. And until the movement is marked by the joyous, defiant singing of revolutionary songs, it lacks one of the distinctive marks of a popular revolutionary movement. It is the dogma of a few and not the faith of the multitude. So I don't want our songs to end up on the scrap heap. They are political songs. It is inevitable that people will have a difficulty with them.
Senator Fintan Moorfield, thank you indeed for joining us on the Insights podcast.
You're welcome, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.